What happens when two Bass Road Warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Find out every Monday at 8 on Notes from an Artist. Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross, and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist. Revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. Every Monday at 8 on CygnusRadio.com. And check out previous episodes on our podcast. NotesFromAnArtist.Buzzsprout.com.
Hi, this is David Gross. I want to welcome you to another edition of Notes from an Artist. Last week, we had an incredible conversation with the great bassist Gary Carr, and it was so good, and we have so much information as well as music, we decided to broadcast it in two parts, so tonight is part two. Without further ado, along with my able-bodied co-host and partner in crime, Tom Semioli, we bring you part two of our interview with Gary Carr.
I guess we could pin the date of the electric bass 1951, but it really wasn't until the 60s that the electric bass really came to the forefront, at least in pop music. What was the feeling when this instrument came on the scene among classical players? Did they take the electric bass seriously? Were they curious about it?
No, as a matter of fact, it bothered me that they weren't at that time. They were not curious. And I thought that because they felt it's a totally another genre, who cares? You know, right. Maybe that was their attitude. But no, I mean, that's why I wanted to get involved with the baby bass and meet all these guys in the electronic world. Mm-hmm. Because I knew that would be the future, and I'm disappointed that the classical players didn't embrace electric more than they did.
Did they see it as a threat at all, or just kind of look down upon it? Because really, the electric bass was the creature of pop music and rock and roll, which was not a respected genre back then. Although, and then of course we want to talk about the jazz, the bass police. Boy, they had a fit when Miles went electric.
That was Miles Davis from the album Jack Johnson. That was Right Off Part 2. We played Right Off Part 1 last week, and I thought we'd continue it on this week. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
Even Ron Carter started playing electric, and some of the more traditional upright players moved over to electric. It's just another tool in the toolbox. It's just another different color. It's just, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that made the electric popular was that jazz moved from the nightclubs to auditoriums. Bass had to be heard. And they were using pickups on the bass, which wasn't as successful in many circumstances as electric, pure electric. And so I think that was one of the reasons why it became popular. It could be heard. That's the other thing.
Right, because you're playing to larger audiences.
Yeah. You play large audiences, and you could have a loud drummer, which we always have. We're always complaining about that. But it didn't matter if you had electric bass. And I think that was one of the stigmas, is that, you know, classical players, me included, our lives are so steeped in the past.
Right.
You know, because we're playing all this old music all the time. And so the old and the new electric, somehow there's this stigma, this barrier there.
It's interesting that a lot of jazz players we've spoken to, and then of course guys like Larry, who also play classical, that was their first instrument, was the electric bass, because they were kids and they had small hands, and hence the electric bass was perfect for them to learn on. In the 60s, when the electric bass became vogue, a lot of the studio players doubled on electric because they wanted to work.
Right.
And now we're seeing that a lot of the upright players that we talked to actually started out playing rock and roll on electric, and then they went to classical and jazz.
A lot of players from our generation, there were no electric bass books. If you wanted to learn to read music, you'd have to do the Bach cello suites, Storch Rabe, Dotzauer. You had no choice. But I think a lot of that melodicism would not have occurred without those early etude books.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. I think, though, the carryover from electric to acoustic opened up a lot of technical possibilities that bass players hadn't thought about before. Mm. I was always happy when I got a student who started out with electric, because he didn't have all the fingering hangups that a lot of classical players have, because they're so steeped in semandel, they never moved away from it. Even the jazzers who were steeped with semandel moved away from it. They didn't use just Simondo fingering. They did everything that they needed to make it work.
You were listening to Freedom Jazz Dance off of the Miroslav Vitus album, Infinite Surge. That is absolutely one of my desert island tunes. The album was renamed Mountains in the Clouds. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I can't believe that at the end of a teaching session that I get paid because I'm the one who learns the most. You probably have had the same experience, haven't you, David?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Particularly when they start saying, well, how do you do this? And then you have to go back to thinking how you do it. And you go, you know what? If I did this, it would be even better than what I was using. So yeah, absolutely. The learning curve is.
You mentioned your six string bass, which the bass police get upset about here on some of our forums because they say a bass should be four strings, no more. Although we had a very interesting conversation with Dave Swift, a great upright player who has a high regard for you. And he says that the electric bass should be six strings because it's closer to the guitar family than it is to, you know, the upright bass. But you, Gary, I heard you say that a three-string bass would be optimum. You said that on one interview.
Well, bass being tuned in fourths is a bit of a problem in that.
Why is that a problem?
Well, the harmonic series of of a note on an instrument tuned in fifths, the instrument is, this is a bit complicated, but if you take the harmonic series on any given note. On the bass, for instance, if you play an A flat on the bottom string, the G string will start vibrating in fourths. So you get this bombardment of intonation that makes it difficult to play the bass in tune in fourths. So people have experimented. There's bass players that tune their basses in fifths.
Did Brad Mitchell tune his bass in fifths?
Yeah. In fact, we were experimenting together with and trying all kinds of different tunings. And when you do it in fifths, it opens the instrument up. The instrument sounds better and it's easier to play in tune.
That was the Thelonious Monk tune, Well You Needn't, Bill Mays on piano and Red Mitchell on bass. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
And the three-string bass had less of that bombardment of intonation. So that's why I probably said that. Having said that, if I were to play electric bass now and start all over again, I would love to play the six-string electric. I would not do anything less than six. Oh, there you go. Wow, that's beautiful.
And note the pastel strings that match his shirt. See, that's a very important part.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Isn't that, that's a gorgeous instrument. What is it?
Well, one bass player referred to it as a coffee table. And one British bass player. And our bass, some of our listeners all took pictures of themselves with their respective instruments and food on top of it to show
support. Oh, wow.
And then I think the bass player actually sent you a coffee table with strings, right? Didn't he?
Exactly. But Bill, there was a guy out in California named Ken Bevensey who does brilliant, brilliant work. And my main concern was I needed to have all six strings the same spacing as a Fender P bass. Yeah. I want that wide spacing. And he managed to do it beautifully. And what I always found interesting, because I've been playing six strings since 81, I've had the same trouble that you've had in terms of doing things a little differently. What ended up happening is I said to one producer, I said, the four strings are in between. So I can go lower if you like, or I can read in two octaves in one position.
So how do you do
that? What's wrong here? Pardon me?
How do you tune it?
B-E-A-D-G-C.
Wonderful idea. I like it. I like it.
And I'll tell you something. When you're talking about the overtone series, you really have to give George Russell a lot of credit because that sharp four really is the harmonic series. So C major, as it were, is really not the root. It's the Lydian. That's where the harmonic series begins.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The six string bass. Have you heard the recording that Steve Bailey did called Carolina?
Yes.
It's his latest recording.
That was Steve Bailey on fretless bass doing the James Taylor classic Carolina in My Mind. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
At Juilliard, when I was a student there, I had never played on a five-string bass, and that's a low C. And I always talk about the sensuality of playing the bass. It's a very sensual instrument. It vibrates against your body. You know. And when I played that low string, I got a hard on.
Brew Viagra, play bass.
Right. And speaking of which, David also has a fretless version, right, with the pink tape wound strings on them, yes?
Yeah.
Which would go very nice with your sweater.
Yeah, it would be lovely. Yeah, salmon.
but you know, it's funny. We were talking with Percy Jones, and fretless is actually easier to play than a fretted bass. And you have the ability to add the nuance of the quarter tone that you really can't with a fretted instrument. You're kind of stuck, which is why lines on a fretted on a fretless is insane.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. There is no way you're going to be able to play, and you're going to use it as a visual, which is really not a good thing. This new student of mine says, how do you play fretless bass? I said, well, you buy the same instrument you have that you have fretted. So your hand's going to be in position. And I see over there, you've got frets on yours. So you're at a disadvantage to begin with.
I'm kind of curious how many jazzers that go from or in pop, how many of them go from classical training on an acoustic to electric bass? How many of them have frets or without frets? Because it seems to me the transition from acoustic bass to electric, you wouldn't want frets.
I wouldn't disagree with that. However, in a working society, you know, you want the gig, you got to do what they want. So I would think a lot of the bass players, whether they prefer the fretless or not, would always go with a fretted, some sort of a P bass or a, wouldn't you agree, Tom? A P bass?
Yeah,
or a P
well, I remember or? Just talking with my former instructor, Ron McClure, who started on upright and then went to electric because that's what he had to do to get work. And he did get work with a band called Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which was a pretty good gig.
Yeah.
And yeah, a lot of them, they did go to frets. And I see a lot of guys who started off in jazz and classical play a fretted bass. Also because at the time, too, fretless basses were pretty uncommon. Now they're everywhere. But when you think about it, fretless bass was kind of rare in the 70s, and then Jaco came along and I guess kind of changed all that.
Yeah.
How was a recall for me, Gary, what when Jaco came out, I think that was probably the first bass player who kind of separated the electric bass from the stigma that it had of being a bastard child of the rock guitar and of the upright bass when you heard that unique voice. What do you recall about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, he carried it to another dimension.
Yeah.
He made a real solo instrument out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was beautiful. His chops were something. I think he established the instrument really as a solo instrument.
Yeah. You talk about a guy, again, who stepped out of the rhythm section and did many, many solo pieces. Portrait of Tracy, that was all solo bass work.
That was Jaco Pastorius, Portrait of Tracy. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
And once again, you've got a player not that dissimilar to Mingus in the fact that they're more recognized for their bass playing than they are for their incredible compositions and arranging skills. And, you know, as time goes on, you can put Duke Ellington, Charles Mingus, and Jaco in the same league as great composer arrangers. And such. He really changed the ballgame, that's for sure.
Now, Gary, you talk about being inspired by jazz bass players. I guess I would cite, I think you cited Paul Chambers and Scott LaFaro in particular. David, I think you'd agree, we recognize them in one phrase, you know, the way they phrase, their tone and things like that. Do you inspire your students to find their own tone? Because it's so easy to try to copy other players. You know, you want to sound like we say, like Jaco. You want to sound like Ron Carter and things like that. But how important is it to discover your own tone?
That's one of the reasons I love Paul Chambers, because he had a beautiful bowed sound. It was gorgeous. It was unique.
That was the great Paul Chambers on bass, a tune from his album Whims of Chambers. That was called We Six. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I would say to anybody that, to me, the sound that you produce is your signature. It's you, because there's so many aspects to producing a good sound that people don't think about. But there's this physical connection with the instrument that's different for absolutely everybody. It's impossible to say.
That was The Swan, a part of Carnival of the Animals. Leonard Bernstein conducting and the great Gary Carr on bass. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
It's just sort of like, do you taste chocolate the same way I do? Do you, you know, when you bow the instrument or pluck the instrument, are you getting the same sensation that I'm getting? Because of that, it's the hardest thing to teach. I would direct anybody. First of all, I agree with you totally that sound is everything. Sound is the basis of anything that you do, because as I said, it's your signature. But I think to create, to connect with the sound that you love, you don't have to copy someone else. You have to, and this is the important word, feel it. And you have to really think about that. How is it? How are you connecting with it physically? Does this really feel good? When I bow across a string, it's the sensation that I have. It equals that of a singer. You know, it's very physical. You feel your lungs. You feel your, the whole part of your body is working. And it's the same thing. When I'm bowing across the strings, there's this physicality, this sensuality that is so delicious. It's the reason why I have the sound that I have, because it's a physical thing.
Yeah.
So I would advise anybody on electric or acoustic, find that physical connection. Think about the physicality and you'll come up with a sound that will be totally yours.
Is that encouraged in the classical world as well? I know in the rock and jazz and pop world, you get away with your own sound, but do conductors really want you to sound a certain way, or do they want you to express your individuality because you are playing music that someone else has written?
Unfortunately, I hope things will change, but unfortunately, as I mentioned before about blending with a section, they tend to want you to sound like everybody else. I really believe that if you had a section of eight players that all had a different sound, it would be phenomenal.
Yeah, sure.
You decided very early on, this is what I'm going to do. And I think that's one of the most wonderful things. You found your sound early and you knew where you were headed with that. And there's a little advice that I think all players should have. And that, listen, when we're kids, oh, I want to be in the Beatles. I want to this, I want to that, right? You got your instrument. But at a certain point, you go, wait a second, what about me? And you had that revelation early, which is, you know, a wonderful thing. And you had a fight long and hard. I mean, that book, you know, you can look at it almost like in with Muhammad Ali, because there you go. Oh, you know, you want that. Come here, please.
Well, I either you're totally stupid or maybe you have something going. First of all, the first fight that I had was with my family because they were bass players.
Right. Yes. And then you really didn't have much of a relationship with them.
Well, they didn't like what I was doing. I heard the bass is a lyrical instrument and they didn't like that.
How could that be?
They made fun of me. You know, it was awful. It was awful. Oh. That was the first big fight. Okay. And maybe that was a good thing because I had to hold on to my own. I had to say, well, I don't care what they say. You know, this is what I like. So that lesson, and that was started at 9 years old.
Wow.
I'll never forget my uncle Bill, who is a bass player, and he plays studio player mostly. He was on the board of the Musicians Union in Los Angeles. And they had a board meeting at my parents' house. And so all these guys, there are probably 20 of them in the room. And my uncle said, hey, Gary, bring your instrument in here and play for these guys. And I did. And I played lyrically. And then he said in front of the whole board, you sound like shit. Those are kinds of memories you don't forget.
Wow. Yeah.
And so I thought, well, you know, I'm going to have to overcome this. You know, do I fall into place and do what my uncle did, playing in the studios and doing all this other work? Or do I do what I want to do?
That's interesting. That's a fascinating story. You know, David, I wonder if that's a product of the classical world, because in the jazz and pop world, where David and I are most familiar with, you're the only bass player in the room most of the time. So you kind of,
No, it has to do with Jewish families.
Is it?
To be perfectly honest.
Well, Italians and Jews, we're all persecuted. We always have.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, right.
Gary, my dad would play saxophone. My mom played piano and sang. And when I became a bass player, they said, you're not going to become a bass player. Your uncle's a bass player. I don't know if you ever knew Phil Leshen. He played bass with Buddy Rich. He managed Lionel Hampton. And my parents, you're not going to be a bass player.
Yeah, well, my family would not accept the fact that I really wanted to be a bass player. They thought it's, you know, he's playing because it's family tradition and it's great for a kid to play in a bunch of orchestras and, you know, it's a good social life and so on at that time. So I was a science major and I actually got accepted into pre-med at UCLA. Wow. So they wanted me to, my son, the doctor, you know. And that's what I was supposed to be, a medical doctor. And it was my high school teacher, Murray Lefkowitz. He said, shame on your family. Very talented. Go down your own road. Follow your own nose. You know, follow your own drummer and do your thing. And he encouraged me. And without my parents knowing, I applied to Juilliard. And he didn't. Wow. They didn't even know about that. I think they were very disappointed.
So I'm doing this live show on MTV at the Palladium in New York. When it's over, I go home. I get a phone call from my mom. She goes, that was very nice. Aunt Gertie wants to know why you move your head so much and when are you getting a real job?
My dad asked me the same thing. You know, I had already played with Bernstein. I was touring around. I was probably making, that was the problem. My father said to me, well into my career, he said, all right, so when are you going to get a job? Because to him, a job is 8 hours. You go to work hating what you do, and then you come home with your family. And that was his whole thing. You know, and I said, Dad, I'm making good living. And he said, how much are you making? Biggest mistake of my life, I told him what my annual earning was, which was at that time four times what he was making. And it humiliated him. It didn't didn't make him happy at all.
Wow.
It's very hard.
I get that.
Yeah.
Now tell us, in 1967, you started the International Society of Bassists. What was your goal when you formed that organization?
I wanted to be around my buddies, you know, I mean, my family. I regarded all bass players as my brothers and sisters. And I thought, why aren't we getting together? You know, we should all be in the same room and celebrate the fact that we all know something about what it is to carry a bass around. And so that was really the motivation. I just wanted to be with my family. And the first year that we had the convention, I thought it was phenomenal. I couldn't believe it. We had 50 bass players all in one space. It was thrilling. I mean, and I don't think I think that was historic, actually. I don't think that ever happened before at 50. And now, you know, the conventions average 1,500.
Wow.
Well, I think, Gary, I don't know if you know who Joe Venuti is. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Well, he called. I don't know if you know this story.
Yeah, that's a great story. You tell the story. It's a beautiful story.
All right. So he, I think he contacted around 50 bass players for a gig. And do you remember the story, Tom? Remember who told us the story?
It was Ron Denny, Carter. Denny Sywell, the drummer from Paul McCartney.
Okay. Yeah. So he said, I got a gig for you called 50 Bass Players. And meet me on the corner of such and such and such and such. So all these bass players started congregating. It was like an ISB meeting, right?
Yeah. And that was probably
all
the
of
first
a sudden, he drives by in a taxi, waving to them all. That may have been the first ISB meeting.
All right.
That could have been.
So anyway, I put Gary Carr in the search engine on the YouTube, David. I don't know if you watch YouTube. All the kids are into this YouTube. And I see this footage of you at a Japanese concert. You rode in on a bike, on a tricycle with your bass on a...
It was one of those old first bicycles with three wheels.
They were big, but
huge, huge front wheel.
Well, I guess that's the only way you could carry it upright. You'd have to have a big tricycle on that.
Yeah,
and you were playing the entertainer in a top hat, David. He had his top hat on.
Yeah,
that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I still think my favorite story from the book, Tom, is playing a duo with a piano player. And when he started to play, you made believe you were falling asleep.
Yeah, actually, there was this piece that Bottesini, the 19th century composer, 19th century composer wrote, called Fantasy La Sonnambula. It was a virtuoso piece with all kinds of variations based on tunes from Bellini. Bellini's opera La Sonnambula. And La Sonnambula, that's a sleepwalker, right? Yeah. And so during the concert, it came to a certain point where I'm playing this lyrical passage and it's kind of boring. And so as I'm playing, I fall asleep on the bass and I start snoring loudly.
That was La Sonnambula, the variations, and that was Gary Carr. And if you listen carefully, you could actually hear Gary snoring in that piece. I really encourage you, search that out on YouTube. You have no idea the facility it takes to play that piece. And Gary just blows me away with all of that technique and all the beauty in that piece. So check that out. It's on YouTube. And this is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I've had a couple of instances where I actually wanted to go to sleep, but that's another story.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Humor and music. How dare you?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did you say? Tom calls you the Victor Borga.
I think that in the classical setting, if you smiled, you were already big Victor Borga. Because I did. I was nothing like his comedic ability. Yeah. I mean, he was totally amazing. I don't know what it was. I could smile and an audience would start to laugh, or I'd do any. I never did real antics ever, yeah. But somehow my humor. And I do have a good sense of humor. Somehow it projected. People laughed, and that was uncommon in a classical setting. You know, it was not exactly.
Well, they think it's such serious music, right?
Yeah, Harmon's in here. He said,
Harmon into the picture.
Yeah. Come say hello. Yeah, I was just sharing my enjoyment, you know, and if I found a piece funny, I wanted everybody else to know it's funny.
Hey, Harmon.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, Harmon. How are you?
How are you? Yeah, that's Tom. That's David.
And I see Harmon has designer glasses as well. This is really, we should call James Spina. We know the editor of 2020. We should get an endorsement.
That's a good idea. Gary has this infectious sense of humor. And so he just starts to play and his love of what he's doing comes through and people interpret it as funny when he's not trying to be funny.
Well, I guess a lot of it really does have to do with the fact that everyone thinks, oh, it's a classical concert. We must be serious. Well,
It is partly that.
It is partly that. I mean, you know, Mozart, for instance, was quite a character. And it reflects that. It's there's a lot of humor in Mozart. And if someone plays Mozart and they don't present the humor of it, the audience is missing out on a part of that man's personality that is really important.
Gary, if you had 5 songs... Nice to meet you, Harmon.
Nice to see you. I have to go see what's going on with the dogs.
Bring them in. Bring them in.
If you could recommend 5 pieces to, let's say, electric players to really get them to experience wonderful pieces of classical music, what would they be?
I wouldn't even need 5. Anything, any of the Bach suites. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd say. Bach.
That was the Bach Cello Suite No. 1 in G, Gary Carr on bass. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com.
I did a Zoom call with some of the people at Berkeley. And to my amazement, I didn't even bring up the subject of Bach. To my amazement, they brought it up. Everybody was playing Bach. Everybody. In fact, Ron Carter sent me a chart. He said, I put out some, I want you to read this chart. Get another player with you or play with your pianist. And I'm going to put the chord symbols for one of the movements of the suite. He said, I'd like you to try that out. It was really good. Really good. But no, I think Bach is the best teacher on both acoustic and electric, for sure.
Wow.
I always thought that Paul McCartney used Bach as the secret weapon to all his beautiful melodic playing.
Yeah, maybe. I would love to ask him.
That was Hello, Goodbye, The Beatles. And if any of Paul McCartney's bass lines articulated a Bach kind of fugue thing, I think that's the number one choice. This is Notes from an Artist, CygnusRadio.com.
Now, Kenny, just you know, you're talking about Bach and we're talking about YouTube. What do you think of YouTube as an educational tool or just... There's so much out there now. I mean, in the old days, well, maybe as not 15 years ago, you only could listen to music. You only had the audio. Now I can dial up Gary Carr. I can dial up Paul Chambers. I can dial up Jaco Pastorius. I can dial up Sid Vicious. I can see all these different players. How does that affect an educator? Because David and I noticed there's a lot of good advice out there, but there's a lot of not so good advice out there.
That is a real problem. I find that, there's two problems with YouTube. First of all, there is nothing like live, and even a CD is already, you know, a step away from that. Tape was the first step away from it, then LP was the second step away from it, then CD right. came along. So YouTube, I mean, you know, how many people have a really good sound system connected to their computer? So this is one thing that's sad, because you can never get the really full quality of anything, and that bothers me. And as you said, I find it really, really disheartening when students who want to learn a particular piece or something like that, they go on YouTube and they listen to other students playing it instead of really first-rate players. I'm wondering if this is actually affecting their sense of discernment with regard to excellence. Are their standards now lowering so they don't even know when they're hearing someone really great that they are great? You know, these are questions I'm now asking about the influence of YouTube. I'm wondering if it's such a good thing at all.
We actually listening to Marcus Miller saying that he has students that can play along with YouTube, but they can't play with other people.
Isn't that awful? Yeah.
Because it's a whole different dynamic. But then on the other side, I mean, it's great to be able to see some of your work on YouTube that you would never see on commercial television or any other medium. So if you really are interested in the art form, you can do some incredible research. Granted, the sound quality isn't great, but hopefully that'll improve. And of course, some of those old TV shows, the original sound wasn't good to begin with.
Yeah, that's true.
But to see you with Richard Davis, you know, in 1968 was fascinating. It's great. Yeah.
Just I'm too live oriented to really enjoy YouTube to a great extent. I mean, even when you have performances on TV and so I have my TV connected to an excellent sound system, so I can hear really good quality sound. But even watching something on TV, to me, it's like screwing with a condiment. There's something that it's just not the real thing.
Right. Fornicating with robots, David. That's yeah. But, you know, we another.
So that was my first wife.
That was. We, you know, obviously with COVID, a lot of musicians, friends of ours, started turning to the streaming platform. And we spoke, we saw a beautiful solo bass concert with Larry Grenadier from the Village Vanguard, which was beautiful visually and the sound was very good. And again, you're right. You know, some of us on a Dell computer, as opposed to plugging it into your smart TV, which you can do. We mentioned it to Ron Carter. He yelled at us. He doesn't believe in streaming concerts. We just interviewed Colin Blunstone from the Zombies, who are still out there, and they did a live show from Abbey Road. And David and I were thinking it's harder for musicians to tour now because of COVID restrictions. And there are some things you just can't do. For example, take the Zombies concert, they brought in a string quartet to accompany them. And you can't really do that on the road. And of course, to travel, as you know, as a working musician, you might have to do 3 or 4 gigs a week to make ends meet. And that's not always feasible. So maybe this streaming platform, while it's not meant to replace live music, but it is a great way to reach an audience in a sense. What do you think about streaming? Yeah,
I agree with you that it is the future. And despite my feelings, I have to accept that. And my only hope is that the quality of sound will continue to improve.
Right.
Right now, I mean, Zoom is one of the major social media connections that people, and Zoom has yet to figure out how to do visuals with sound.
Yeah, but I think, we're doing Zoom now. In another 5 years, this will look like a silent movie to, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So the future is, we'll have a lot of good things in store, I think.
We were talking with Colin Blunstone from the Zombies last week, and I said to him, I said, if it was going to be Zoom, it would have already happened. They've had 18 months of COVID to fix it, and they haven't. So it's got to be someone else.
Right. The technology has to be developed, and unfortunately, we're not all on the same bandwidth. For example, we just had rain in the Northeast, and David, you're dropping out a little bit, but here in, you know, on the Upper East Side, I'm somewhat stable, but then, you know. So Gary, to wrap up, what does Gary Carr still have to do? What's on your bucket list?
Well, right now I'm working on, there's a quintet that Vaughan Williams wrote for Normal String Quintet. And Daniel Nix, he's a fabulous bass player in Texas. And he has a quartet that's phenomenal players. Done some interesting recordings, and he's raised the bar for, without a doubt, on bass quartet playing. And he wanted to do this Vaughan Williams and asked me if I would join him. So that's what I was practicing this morning. I'm getting ready for that recording that we're going to do together. So that's my next project. I always have a project. I mean, you know, I'm an old guy yet, but I still have some chops, you know. So as long as I have the chops, I'll keep going. As soon as I start feeling, really, you know, my standard is getting lower, then I'm going to stop. I'll never stop for myself. I'll always play. I love to play. And I play, you know, every day I play Bach.
Okay.
You know, even when I'm working on volume, I started the day with at least a couple movements of a Bach suite just to get my head right.
David, anything else?
This is wonderful. This will be on October 11th.
Great. You'll email me. And then, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And we also make this a podcast because, David, the kids love those podcasts, don't they?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I like podcasts.
I love them too, actually. Yeah. It's great that radio now has moved into that because now we can, we have more choices, I think.
I mean, I'm so.
And Tom and I have the face for radio, so we're good.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Yeah.
But I have to get pastel strings for my instruments. I can't.
You know. Well, I'll send you some.
Please.
I've got pink neon strings. They're really pretty.
Yes, but I have to. I need the clothing to go with it. All right, Gary. Well, great talking to you.
Good to talk to you.
Regards to you guys. And we'll email you all the links and everything else. All right. Great. Talk again. Bye-bye, guys.
Well, bye.
Bye then.
You were just listening to Small Suite by Alec Wilder, Harmon Lewis on keyboards, and the great Gary Carr on bass. And before that, we listened to a part of The Deer Hunter called Cavatina, also Harmon Lewis on piano and Gary Carr on bass. I want to thank my co-host, Tom Semioli, and of course, Gary Carr, for not one, but two parts, 2 weeks of incredible music and incredible dialogue. This is Notes from an Artist on CygnusRadio.com, and I want to let you know that we are now archiving all of our radio shows via our podcast, Notes from an Artist. It's available on all podcast players and also at notesfromanartist.buzzsprout.com. Again, I want to thank all of you for listening. Have a wonderful week. Next week, we've got an incredible show with Mark Andes, great bass player from Spirit, Heart, JoJo Gunn. We got a lot to talk about. Speak to you then. Have a great week. Bye now.
Hi, this is David Gross.